Words on Water.
Welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is Travis Loop, the host, and this episode is going to dig into environmental and water journalism a little bit. I am here with Mark Schleffstein. He is a longtime environmental reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans and for NOLA.com. He's covered a lot of water issues, including commercial fisheries, the disappearing coast of Louisiana, through sea level rise and subsidence, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, Hurricane Katrina, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, lots of huge stories. And he won a lot of awards, including the 2006 Pulitzer Prizes for public service and breaking news reporting. So, Mark, thanks for agreeing to be on the other side of the interview.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
You've kind of chosen to stay on this beat, if you will, and cover these issues involving water. Why do you feel they're important, and what keeps you interested?
My entire career, I've always felt that it's important to cover water issues in New Orleans because it's so important to our residents and to our businesses. And, of course, all of that became extremely clear with Hurricane Katrina. And a lot of that has to do with safety, and a lot of it has to do with environmental quality and the ability of making sure that our coast continues to survive in ways that both protect humans and also provide the opportunity for natural resources to continue to thrive, which ends up helping residents of the New Orleans area in terms of fisheries.
You know, it's been a tough 10, 15 years, I guess, for the newspaper industry. So many cuts to newsroom staff, you know, and I know your model here has changed as kind of part of that evolution, if you will. What's your take on how the cuts across, you know, newspaper newsrooms have impacted environmental journalism?
Well, they certainly have. And I guess my concern moving forward, you know, you look at our staff, and we went from 240, 260 reporters prior to Katrina to today, maybe 70 to 80 on our staff.
Wow.
I mean, it's a significant change.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, our roles have changed as well. So before, you know, I was a reporter and I wrote. Well, now I'm a reporter and a photographer and a videographer and an audio reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to make sure that I have graphics, find the graphics myself because we no longer have a graphics staff.
Yeah.
And I have to do all of those and do all of those for each individual story. Plus, there's a significant change in the emphasis on the kinds of reporting we're doing. There's a push to go with shorter stories, stories that are much more adaptable to being online. The way we work actually is that our stories appear online first, and then they're taken by other people and put into the print edition later.
Mm-hmm.
So we're basically working for the online product, the NOLA.com. So those are key concerns. That what has happened is that the result of that, New Orleans is sort of an odd situation because in our downsizing, there was a major blowback in the community for that, major opposition to what was happening. And part of that resulted in a local individual buying the Baton Rouge newspaper and starting a New Orleans edition of that Baton Rouge paper and hiring many of our employees to run it. One of the ironies here is that staffers that left us have found places both at that other paper, but also at nonprofit online organizations. Mm. There's one called The Lens here.
Okay.
And also on TV, we have some of our key reporters are now investigative reporters for two of the three major news stations in town. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like this market, the people here still have an appetite for the depth of news and for these types of water and environmental stories.
They do, but that there's still, you know, the issue remains: how do we financially survive in this new in this new world of journalism? And I've found that one of the ways to survive is for individuals to go out and look for money, and that's what I did, and ended up being able to get a grant from. Through SEJ from the Walton Family Foundation to pay for two staffers to cover coastal issues full time.
Wow.
That's in addition to me. Now, I don't get any money from the grant, but the grant pays for them. And we've also taken advantage of things like this past year, this summer we had an intern that was funded by the American Association for Advancement of Science. And actually she was a PhD candidate. From the University of Florida, and she came on staff for 10 weeks. And we're hoping once she graduates that we may be able to find money to, again, grant money to pay for her to come back.
That's very interesting that nonprofits and foundations are kind of backfilling a little bit or coming into this vacuum and trying to...
Well, I think they're recognizing the holes, the potential holes that can occur. I know Walton did that. One of the ironies about... the Walton grant was that we made clear, and especially by running the grant through the Society of Environmental Journalists, that we're going to control what we do with the money. That basically they had the opportunity of using the word coast, and that's it. So we are limited to covering coastal issues, but what those coastal issues are, we determine. And so there's been, you know, they're very happy with what we're doing, but they don't really have any role in the individual day-to-day reporting or anything else. Yeah. Those are the kinds of issues that we're trying to continue to do through both Society of Environmental Journalists. SEJ has its own smaller grants for freelance writers and for individual reporters to do individual projects as well.
Shifting a little bit, well, I would say also the public's interest in environmental and water issues. What are the stories that they seem to care about? I mean, at least in your market here, you know, what actually resonates with the public when it comes to, you know, those buckets?
Well, there are a number of things. You know, the obvious ones are in the aftermath of the BP oil spill. What has happened to fisheries? There are so many people in our community that are tied to fisheries either by being fishers or by working for restaurants that are using the product. And so that's a key issue. Oil and gas production and development of the oil and gas industry is another key one. There are so many places where that industry coincides with water, and sometimes it can be for good and sometimes it can be for bad, as we've seen. So those are key issues. Getting back to BP, the biggest thing right now is that, you know, the state has this major problem with the loss of wetlands along its coast, and it has had the opportunity of using a huge chunk of money from settlements made with BP and Transocean, the company that had the drilling rig, to pay for a number of those projects to restore coastal wetlands. So those are key issues that I think our readers are interested in. And then they're interested in, you know, concerns about the potential for contamination of water in the Mississippi River. The ability to go fishing, and changes in recreational fisheries, the potential that some of the major projects that the restoration program has, especially the diversion of sediment and water to rebuild wetlands, that it's going to change the kinds of fish that can be caught and the staging of when fisheries can be caught, especially shrimp, and changes in the way that oysters are grown.
What I just want to kind of follow up on a couple of these to hear what the latest is. So the disappearing coast. Mm-hmm. How fast is it disappearing right now? And how much of that is attributed to sea level rise versus subsidence, erosion, kind of that, right. that mix?
Let's back up and talk about the reasons why wetlands disappear in Louisiana. Up until a couple of years ago, it was clear that the major reasons for loss of wetlands were subsidence, the natural sinking of the land, or the unnatural sinking of the land in areas where oil and gas are being produced, where it's being removed from oil and gas deposits from deep below the water, and mm-hmm. that's actually caused the land to drop some. We also have the fact, you know, the overriding reason for many of the losses is that the natural way that the Mississippi River acts has been changed really in the last 200 years, so that it no longer wanders along our coastline, moving from place to place every 500 years or so. Mm-hmm. It's now locked in one place south of New Orleans, and the result of that, it's also been levied all the way to its end, and there have been methods used to assure that the water flows fast out the mouth so that sediment doesn't deposit there. And the result of all that is that all of that sediment goes offshore instead of what it used to do, which is every spring it used to flood into the inland areas and increase the height of the wetlands. Mm. So that's been cut off for 100 years, 150 years.
Yeah.
And the result of that is another major reason for loss of wetlands. It's increased the speed of the subsidence that's occurred. And then you've got the oil and gas industry itself. We've got 10,000 miles of canals that were built. Some of them were connected directly to the Gulf of Mexico, so you had salt water coming in. And the salt water itself causes problems when you're putting it into freshwater wetlands. Mm-hmm. And so that's increased. You know, those are the historic ones. Now you add sea level rise caused by global warming, and that now is becoming a much bigger, still a smaller proportion for New Orleans, but it's still a bigger percentage today than it was a couple of years ago, and will continue to increase over time.
Yeah.
And that's a major concern going forward, and the state Coastal Protection Restoration Authority has recognized that, and it has sent out a warning saying in 50 years, we're going to see major increases in sea level rise that will flood a number of our coastal wetlands if we don't get these projects built.
Unfortunately, we live in this part of the world where there's great skepticism or denial about climate change.
That's true.
And global warming.
That includes in New Orleans.
Yeah.
People are complaining about the fact that their wetlands are being lost. You know, one of the ironies here is that the most recent study done by the U.S. Geological Survey last year showed that we've actually slowed down a little bit in terms of the loss of wetlands. It used to be a football field every 60 minutes. Now it's a football field every 100 minutes. And one of the ironies is that in that calculation that they made, they said that one of the reasons why it's slowed down is because some of these coastal restoration projects have already been put in place and have increased in small areas the amounts of wetlands that exist.
Mm-hmm. So, but you're still losing a football field every 100 minutes.
That's
staggering.
It's outrageous. And the concern is that, you know, another Hurricane Katrina on our coast will dramatically increase that. Katrina itself caused immediate loss of about 200 square miles of wetlands.
Mm. That's amazing. I actually live in Wilmington, North Carolina, so
you
just
know,
had,
you know what's happening with this stuff. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I get stuck on that climate change piece and people just denying that science and people that are at the forefront of the impacts denying that. It's just kind of amazing. I've been reading a book about Tangier Island in the Chesapeake Bay, mm-hmm. and their island is disappearing. Subsidence is a big factor, but also sea level rise, and they don't want to believe that either.
Right. And that's a community that dates back to, 1611, I
think. Yeah.
And it really is an irony, and they're now demanding you know, levees like us
to
protect the island, and it's going to be a real problem.
What, also kind of getting back to the Mississippi River and what's coming down that river, and, you know, the nutrient pollution and having the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, what's kind of just the latest on the size of that? I know it changes year to year based on flow and other conditions, but.
Right. We had a little bit smaller year this year, but it's sort of one of these odd issues. So, you know, I think it may have been, not quite sure of exactly how big it was, but it was well over what the target is. You know, I think the target is, I'm trying, 5,000 square miles.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But it was much bigger than that. It was about 8,000, I think. But it was smaller than expected, and unfortunately, in part, that was the result of weather conditions and the fact that they do a cruise once a year to do this, and the cruise just happened to coincide with some storms that mixed the water in some areas, but it also coincided with a period where the water, where much of the low oxygen water also moved east, and so the low oxygen water was stacked up much higher. So in one area you had much less oxygen through all levels of the water, as opposed to on the western end where you had low oxygen at the bottom, which is still a major problem, but it didn't go up as high in the system.
How much do the people of this area, you know, point their fingers upstream and demand some action on, that nitrogen and phosphorus?
Well, you know, the environmental groups in town do.
Yeah.
The fishers do a little bit, but not much. It's basically, you know, it's backyard sort of a thing. You know, we are directly affected by it. And so the fishermen complain about the fact that, you know, they can't catch fish or shrimp where they would expect to. They have to go farther out to get it. But, then saying, oh, yeah, and that's because of all the farms in the Midwest. They don't quite get there, although there have been some efforts made, especially by environmental groups, to connect Iowa farmers and Louisiana fishers, which is seems to be helping a lot.
That's interesting. I guess the last kind of issue I wanted to talk about specifically was the impacts in the water, the coastline, the water, now 8 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and just kind of what's the science showing?
Well, to begin with, you know, one of the things that's hard for people to understand is that because the federal government did such a quick job of shutting down all fisheries, there was no real opportunity for contaminated fish to get into the marketplace. So that was not a problem. The concern is that there may be some long-term effects on the life cycle of fisheries themselves, and that's still an outstanding question. One of the concerns that is significant here is that oysters have had a real problem coming back, and the oysters may have been affected by the oil, but they were definitely affected by the fact that the state had actually opened up all of the diversions that it had in place at that time to allow fresh water to enter into those areas, and it killed lots of oyster beds.
Okay.
And those oyster beds have had a difficult time coming back. And so that's a longer term effect, and it's going to be difficult in the future. That's going to be one of the key issues with these diversions, is that the state is actually going to have to figure out where new areas are that oyster beds can be grown. And it's not going to be in the traditional places, and it's going to be farther out. So it's going to be more costly to oyster growers, and will cause some changes. The state's going to have to deal with it. It's going to be a mitigation problem as part of their permits for those projects. They're going to have to financially come up with a plan to deal with the effects of the diversions.
Bringing it back to, I guess, the city here, and I want to kind of ask about infrastructure and so forth. I mentioned last year when you received an award from the U.S. Water Alliance for your reporting, you gave a great speech about that. And one thing you said is, you're saying editors think infrastructure is a bad 14-letter word. and I think that that's a reference to readers hearing that word infrastructure and then turning the page. But yeah, could you elaborate and kind of what you meant by that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it has been a year later. And so Donald Trump has adopted the word infrastructure and it has become part of his policy, although the money hasn't flowed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's pipes and ditches and things like that are hard for people to get a handle on and say, gee, you know, we need to be really worried about this unless it directly affects them.
Yeah.
The problem in New Orleans and the reason why it's easier here is that, unfortunately, it's affected them way too often.
Yeah.
And especially with our sewerage and water board, which handles sewer, water, and drainage, that's been a key issue, especially since Hurricane Katrina. It was a key issue before Katrina, and people tend to forget that. When I first came here in 1984, the auditor for the Sewerage and Water Board warned the Sewerage and Water Board that it needed to raise rates because it was not keeping up with maintenance. That warning was placed in every single audit over the next 30 years and was basically ignored until after Katrina, where it became clear that the Sewerage and Water Board had to do something about it. So it did. It placed a heck of a lot of effort into its water and sewer system, rebuilding both, which needed to be done after Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And drainage became a less focused on issue until last August, when there was a major, it was a thunderstorm.
Uh-huh.
It was literally a thunderstorm over part of the city, and it caused problems. And what it did was it pointed out that the city's pump stations were in complete disarray. Half of them weren't working, or more than half. And the electric power plant that operated all the pump stations also was not working properly and was not able to produce the power and provide it to those pump stations.
Mm.
And that led to major changes here in who runs the Sewerage and Water Board, and concerns that, you know, there will be additional rate increases required for water, sewer, and electricity to pay for all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still looking at billions of dollars
mm.
just for that part, the interior drainage, which is on top of the billions of dollars that have already been spent on the levees on the outside and mm. the pump stations at the ends of the canals to take the water that the city is pumping out from the city and making sure it's able to get into Lake Pontchartrain when a hurricane occurs and they have to close the canals.
Mm-hmm. So now, maybe, like you said, a year later and some of these things have happened, maybe there's a little bit more, the word infrastructure might resonate a little bit, or people
yeah,
might have a little more
interest. The reality is my editors are still looking for a shorter word because it doesn't fit well in headlines.
Yeah, no, it's true. One of the last things is, you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but in your 3+ decades of reporting around here, being part of SEJ, you know, how have you seen the management of water issues change, you know, especially by utilities and so forth?
I think we're now at a point where the city finally recognizes that it really has to become professional and view all three parts of its system, water, sewer, and drainage, in a professional way, which it hadn't done before. So that's an improvement. One of the ironies is that I see one of the problems that New Orleans had was that it was a leader in water issues back at the turn of the 20th century, when it actually created the huge pumps that were in its pump stations, the Baldwin Wood pump that was adopted by the Netherlands as their pump for their pump stations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been this conceit on the part of the Sewerage and Water Board ever since that, you know, we've got the greatest drainage system in the world. Well, yeah, but it was designed for a community that existed in 1912.
Mm-hmm.
And the city's footprint has changed dramatically since then. And its needs have changed. And one of the realities is that its rainfall has changed as well.
Yeah, sure.
It actually has had a couple of inches more rainfall per year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're now a little bit above 60 inches of rain a year. And that's a heck of a lot of water to deal with. Mm. So it's, we're on the cusp of a new era, I see, for with the, you know, the hiring of someone who actually is an expert in this kind of thing mm-hmm. to run the sewage and water board. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good sign moving forward for where the city's going.
Yeah. Last question is, I'm wondering if you can kind of give advice to the water sector and especially, you know, public utilities and so forth as they try to connect with the media and to get coverage of these issues and these stories. Do you have any advice for going about that?
The key one is to be open and bring us in and let us see what's going on. We can be better friends. We can be better as your friends than your enemies. Mm-hmm. We can be partners in providing the information that you give us to the public and might actually be able to help you figure out things that you might be doing wrong that we can help you correct. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been pushing is development of a much better online system of showing where how much rain is falling throughout the city so that people can know better. I think Houston actually had that in place in some parts of their community prior to the
Hurricane Harvey. Yeah.
But it wasn't really well used by the media there. We have the opportunity of doing something similar here. The Sewage and Water Board had already moved towards at least a part of that since the August 5th flood last year. It's had a spreadsheet that's updated every day on what pumps are out and what electric stuff is out. So the public can look at any time and see, you know, the pump on my street is not working properly.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. But having the rainfall information out there in real time would help as well. And I know that there's a potential for that information to be developed in coordination with the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, which is trying to develop something like that statewide to show water levels in different areas, and also with the levee authority, the regional levee authority, that's trying to do the same thing for showing people when gates are closed and what water levels are in the canals leading up to those gates.
Yeah. So have a more engaged relationship with your local press and try to, like you said, bring them in, show what's happening, not just when there's an issue, not just when there's some shiny new ribbon to cut, but right. kind of an ongoing dialogue about here's what's happening, here's what we're doing, and so forth.
Exactly. And the Sewage and Water Board has already taken a step in that direction in that it actually hired a reporter from our staff that was covering City Hall to mm-hmm. be their key public information officer.
Yeah.
So that's helpful.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Mark, I appreciate the time. As someone that was a former reporter myself, nowhere near your level, but really loves reporting and journalism, it's awesome getting to talk to somebody like you. So I appreciate it, and I look forward to sharing this with folks out there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Words on Water.